Welcome to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the podcast where we uncover the secrets of CEOs, entrepreneurs, and visionaries who've used public speaking to skyrocket their businesses and their bottom line. Get ready for captivating stories, valuable insights, and practical wisdom from the trailblazers who've mastered the art of the stage. I'm your host, Kelly O'Hara, and I'm thrilled to bring you their experiences and expertise directly to you. Let's get started. What if I told you that your workforce has the potential to deliver an encore performance every single day? If only they were given the right stage to shine. Today, we're diving into the intersection of business, music, and workplace culture with a man who's lived on both sides of the mic. Gregory Offner isn't just another leadership speaker. He's a dueling pianist turned corporate strategist who's cracked the code on what makes people truly engaged at work. After nearly losing his voice forever, he didn't just rebuild it, he redefined his entire approach to performance, both on stage and in the business world. He's spoken to audiences across five continents, sharing how companies can create workplaces that inspire passion, commitment, and dare I say it, actual enjoyment. Today, we're going to explore the tip jar culture, Gregory's game-changing philosophy for re-engaging employees and reigniting performance. Get ready for a conversation that's part leadership masterclass, part rock concert, and all about shaking up the way we think about work. Gregory Offner is the founder of the Global Performance Institute, an award-winning keynote speaker and the guy companies call when they need to fix disengagement and burnout from the inside out. But before that, he spent over a decade leading sales and marketing teams by day and igniting crowds as the dueling piano performer by night. Then, like a cruel joke, his voice gave out and the diagnosis? Surgery. 15 of them, actually. And in the middle of that fight to rebuild his voice, he made a discovery. The same techniques that make a packed piano bar electrifying are the exact ones missing from most workplaces today. And that realization led him to develop the tip jar culture, a simple yet powerful framework that helps leaders create workplaces where employees don't just show up, but they want to show up. His book, The Tip Jar Culture, How to Reengage and Reignite Your Workforce, challenges everything we thought we knew about work, motivation, and what it really takes to get people invested. Today, we're diving deep into the real reason people are disengaged, how businesses can turn things around without throwing more money at the problem, and how Gregory's background in music gave him an edge most business strategists just never saw coming. Gregory, I'm telling you, there's a lot to say about you, clearly, but I want to welcome you to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight. We need you.
Thanks, Kelly. It's great to be here. Man, I got to have you write my stage intro. That was fantastic. I loved it. Thank you.
I'm excited about this. You really, truly are a rock star. But before we get into what you do for work today, I'd really like to rewind a bit because you're career, it's just been anything but traditional. We're talking corporate leadership to dueling pianos to keynote stages. Tell me what the moment was that you realized you're really destined for something different.
I had just finished my fourth vocal cord surgery. And in between each surgery, there's a period of complete silence where the vocal cords need to heal. So they can't move at all. Not a sound, not a whisper, not a whistle. Thank God for cell phones, because that's how my wife and I would communicate sitting on the couch. We would text each other. But it was very isolating for someone who used his voice all the time, speaking by day as a salesperson and sales trainer, singing by night as a dueling piano bar and piano bar performer. And so I'm post fourth surgery, and I'm waiting for the subway to go to work. Remember, I had this day job because I wasn't making Beyonce money as an entertainer, so I needed a day job. And I was in the depths of depression, although I didn't know that it was depression at the time. I was in the depths of depression from losing that social connection, from losing that sense of me that happens to someone who is a vocal performer like we are as speakers. And so I'm standing there on the subway platform, and I had this terrible thought that maybe it wasn't in the subway, but in front of the subway that I belonged that morning. And realizing that was not what I wanted to do, I sought out some help. And in between my first appointment with a therapist, I saw a TV commercial, or more appropriately, a Netflix commercial. And it was a commercial for a new documentary called I Am Not Your Guru. Okay, this is the Tony Robbins documentary that was done in the 2018, maybe-ish. And I had always thought Tony Robbins was a bit of a charlatan, sort of, you know, look at me, you're the best coach in the world type of guy. And in fact, a friend had tried to give me one of his books back in 2009. And I remember vividly reading the first page or two of this book and something to the effect of, as I rode in my helicopter and we passed over top of the school where I used to be a janitor, I thought, wow, how things change. And I remember I read that paragraph and had this very visceral bull reaction. And so I threw the book into the wheel well, into the passenger area of my car, and didn't really ever think of Tony as somebody I'd be interested in ever. But there I was watching this documentary. Now, the listeners have to know that I studied philosophy and psychology in college. So all of a sudden, I'm watching this documentary and seeing actual therapeutic interventions, stuff that I learned about in college, being done in this seminar. And so I thought, you're going to try one thing, why not try a couple things? And I bought myself a ticket to a Tony Robbins event. And so a few months later, there I am at this event. It's a 4-day event. And day one, I went in, don't touch me, don't hug me, I don't want to go, yes, I don't want to high five you, I'm just here to watch. And at some point in the day, open seating is how they structure these events. So you don't have an assigned seat, you have an assigned area, and you can sit anywhere in that area. At some point during the day, a woman was sat next to me. And we wound up standing behind each other in the concession stand later that day. We hadn't really interacted much, did one or two of the activities together, but didn't really chit chat. We're in the concession line and she turns around and says, how many of these events have you been to? Now, mind you, it's very loud in this arena, and so I don't want to talk more than I have to because I don't want to risk re-injuring my voice. So I thought I'd give her an answer and then flip the conversation back to her. So I said, this is my first one. How about you? And she said, this is my 13th. I went, oh my God, who comes to, does this, must not work if you're coming to 13 of them. Why do you keep coming back? And she proceeded to tell me her life story, her journey. And it was a doozy. It was incredible. The highs, the lows, the drama, the intrigue. It was fascinating. And then she said, what about you? And I don't know if you've ever had this happen where somebody shares something so amazing. You're like, nobody cares about me. Let's hear more about that because that was amazing. That's how I felt in that moment. And so I said, no, thanks, but no, nobody really cares about my problems. And she said, no, tell me your story. Why are you here? Why did you decide to come? This is your first event. And Kelly, I've always believed in the power of strangers. When we speak to strangers and when we're honest with strangers, they'll often be very honest with us because they have nothing emotionally invested in us and we have nothing emotionally invested in how they see us. So I decided I was going to be very honest and very vulnerable with the stranger. And her name is Svetlana. So I told Svetlana everything I'd been going through, how the fact I was here today was only the result of me standing on a subway platform thinking I should get in front of the subway train, and why I was feeling that way and how frustrated and scared, frightened I was of the future. And as we talked and walked around the arena, Svetlana listened, asked a couple of probing questions as the talk continued. And now we've been walking for about 10, 15 minutes and I'm talking and I'm at the end of my explanation. And she looks at me and she goes, you don't see it, do you? I said, see what? I get chills every time I tell this story. She says, you've been telling me about all these different parts of your life that you see as separate. There's this musician thing that you do, and then there's this sales thing that you do, and then there's your passion for helping others and your interest in psychology and philosophy and how we think. And you keep all these things separate. And I just wonder what it might look like if you put all that into one thing and did that. And I was like, yes, Svetlana, I wonder that too. You clearly have something in mind. What do you think that might be? And she took me by the shoulder and she turned. And now we're looking down the sort of hallway that you go from the concourse back into the seating area of the arena. I forget what that's called. But so we're looking down that hallway and we can see the stage. And she points at the stage where Tony Robbins was just speaking. And she goes, I think you'd be there. And it hit me like a lightning bolt because I had never, ever considered that maybe the stage was the perfect place for me to marry all of these things I'd been interested in. And now she'd put this bug in my brain. And so that night I went back to the hotel room. Remember, it's a 4-day session. I went back to the hotel room and I implemented one of the principles that Tony had actually shared that day. He said, who would you need to become to be the person you've always wanted to be? And so I started to write down on this paper, okay, who would I need to become to be a keynote speaker? What are the things I'd need to know? What would I need to do? How would I structure my time and on? And after the program ended a couple days later, I went back home and I shared this idea with my wife and I started reaching out to people on LinkedIn who were coaches, consultants, keynote speakers, and I started to interview them. A quick phone conversation for some. We'd sit down over coffee for others that were local. And I wound up sitting down with between 40 or 50 people. And to a person, they said, one of the questions I asked was, what's the hardest part about what you do? Like, what's the thing you wish you knew was going to be so hard before you got into this that you now know is so hard? And to a person, whether they were a coach, a consultant, or a speaker, they said, new business generation, sales, it's the hardest part of this. And Kelly, so I go, I've been doing sales for companies I don't even care about. I'm doing pretty darn good at it. I could, if that's the hardest part of this job, baby, I got this.
You're made.
That was what solidified in my mind that this was going to be the path for me. And thankfully, I've also met great mentors and been introduced to phenomenal organizations like NSA, the National Speakers Association, and others. And I feel like I've just found my tribe, that I passionately believe that this is the place I've always been meant to be. And it just needed that experience in life of losing my voice, of realizing how precious the ability to speak and influence others truly is, to find it.
What, I love this story. And I have to say, you know, when I started this podcast, it was really to help people across all industries realize that it is so important that you speak about what you do and that it's not just about getting up in front of a huge stage with thousands of people. It can be all kinds of different stages, including a podcast. It can be so many different ways of doing it. But the other piece to what we do, and what I love so much, is hearing the story of how people get to where they're going. How did you end up here? And that was absolutely the most perfect story of how you've got to step above it and look at the pinpoints that needed to happen. What were those juggernaut pieces that had to come together? And I love this story because it started with Tony Robbins, initial resistance, and then, okay, things are tough enough, I'm going to give it a try. If you had not gotten that show, if you hadn't gotten that bug to go to that show, you wouldn't have met that woman. Mm. If you hadn't met her in the line to concessions, you wouldn't have gotten her perspective, which was really about you discovering your perspective, developing your own perspective on it. But it had to be someone that would notice you, that would see you, that would see something you didn't see yet. Mm-hmm. I love these kind of stories. They're absolutely delicious. And Tony Robbins, I've been to that 4-day event too. And I have to share, when I went to the event, the big thing is you're going to walk across fire. I don't know how it was for you when you went, but you're going to walk across fire. And I remember rallying my company to send several of us to go to this. And in my mind going, I'm not walking that fire. I'm not doing it. It's not going to happen. And then when I got there thinking, and just a personal story, thinking maybe by Sunday, I might be willing to do it. And he does it on the first night. Not doing this, sleep thick to me, and coming up with every excuse, standing in the line to do, and getting in the line and going, hey, at the last minute, if I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do this. Mm-hmm. I am not. And then getting close and seeing the coals all start to turn white. Ooh, they're cooling down. Maybe I'll do this. Right before I got in the line, they brought all the new coals out. I did walk it, and it did change your life. You did realize, oh my God, this is amazing. But I only share that because a personal experience with Tony Robbins is that don't be negating this guy who really pulls out the best in you and really has some incredible vision. Yeah, I had an experience, but isn't it amazing how this one experience changed the trajectory of your life? And I thought to myself while you were telling that story, strangers, I don't know, yes, but they're meant to be, aren't they? It turns out that person was so important for you.
Oh, yeah. And she's, after my wife, the second person I thank in my book is Svetlana, because if she hadn't turned around and talked to a stranger in the concession stand, none of the things that I've been able to do, I don't think would have happened.
So that's amazing. So that stranger is so meant to be. That was so yeah. part of your path. I absolutely love that. And it took all those pieces to come together. Same thing if you go back even further, just noticing, is that if you hadn't had the surgery, all the surgeries, if you hadn't lost your voice, you wouldn't have found, probably, who knows, but maybe another path would have revealed itself to you, but you wouldn't have found the path you're on, that it looks like you're having such a good time and incredible success.
Well, thank you for that. It is the best worst or the worst best thing that's ever happened to me, because it was, I believe, a kick in the pants from the universe, sort of saying, we gave you this gift and you're not doing much with it. And I will say, when I look back at my professional employment history, I worked for some great organizations. I worked for some lemons, but I worked for some great organizations. My success at some of them, I largely attribute to what I learned, who I worked with and for, and my desire to prove that I can do anything. In some cases, it was people saying, we don't know if you're a right fit. And I was like, I'll show you who's a right fit. But then the minute I had achieved that, I lost interest in the goal. So I was doing these day jobs where I was never really fully committed to what I was doing. There was always some other reason for it. And it never fulfilled me. I never felt like I was making a real impact. Even though I did well financially, and I got promoted several times in organizations. And then at the piano bar also, I had opportunities to, if you'd consider this going from the minor leagues to the majors, go to Vegas and perform, go on cruise ships and do that circuit. And I always played it safe. I would play in local bars or play when I'd travel. And so I frankly didn't take my voice seriously, meaning the way that a true vocalist would care for their voice. I abused my voice. I was often the loudest guy in the loudest places for the longest amount of time. I would smoke cigarettes. I would drink alcohol during performances, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it dries out your vocal cords. So it's not very good for your voice, is what I'm saying. I just did not respect this gift that the universe had given me, nor was I think I doing it justice. And so I really do believe that this vocal cord injury I had was the universe going, look, pal, this could be gone. So you better do something with it. And I'm grateful, as weird as that is to say, for all those surgeries and everything that happened that got me here. I'm incredibly grateful.
I think in the end, too, gratitude is such a key issue. It's such a key player in everything. If you don't have it, you lose it. I do believe that. I think people lose it in one way or another. It was your voice, but I think that's phenomenal that if you found the gratitude in all, that's an interesting sign to share. I love that. Now here's something else. Based on all the research I was able to do on you in advance, you've got this great career that's in corporate sales. One of the hardest things to do is sales and risk management, and you're moonlighting as a pianist. You got two worlds that seem completely opposite. When did you start seeing the connections between them, that, wow, I can use this to, because you're obviously a compelling person, a compelling speaker. You obviously know how to tell a great story. You've already proven that. That's delicious. But when did you put that together of, I'm going to marry these two things together in such a way that feeds the pipeline.
It wasn't until I left the corporate world that I had the, I'll call it psychological distance, to be able to start to see the connections. When I was in the situation, so working for the organization, there couldn't have been a brighter line between who I was and what I did 9 to 5 and who I was and what I did when I was at the piano bar. But the distance gave me the opportunity and learning about a problem that needed to be solved. I think the solution, if you will, my perspective on work and what we can bring from the piano bar into the work world, it was always there. I just didn't have a problem to apply it to. I'm not sure if that makes sense or not, but it was learning about what a challenge engagement and retention and burnout and the opposite of engagement, disengagement, was in the workplace. I started going, it's a hell of a problem at the piano bar too. When you have an audience that doesn't want to do anything, or if they're like, oh God, you want us to clap again? Come on. I mean, that, so what did we do? How did we manage the evening to make sure that the audience went on this emotional and energetic ride with us, that we didn't take them too high too early or else they'd burn out, and that we made sure we were not front loading the evening with all of the greatest hits, but also not making them wait so long that they gave up on us. There are these little strategies, these techniques that we used at the piano bar, that when I started to look for the parallels between the workplace and the piano bar, all of a sudden the lines couldn't have been clearer.
All of that really is about keeping people engaged, whether they're employees of yours or whether they're coworkers of yours or whether they're listeners of yours. What do you do to keep, and actually, as you're describing this, I'm thinking, you already described that you were bored. You took different jobs and you had success, but then you get them bored. So if that's the case, what better testing ground was there than for you to look at, wow, I'm having success here. I'm now getting bored. How do you recover that? How do you get them to reengage? That turns out to be your mission. That turns out to be why you're here, your business, but it's tied to a mission. There's nothing better than that.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
That's wild. What do you think? Is that the reason that you established the Global Performance Institute?
That is an interesting question. The Global Performance Institute was initially going to be a home for other speakers, coaches, and consultants that needed sales support. Because I thought, I'm going to coach and speak and consult myself, but I know there's other coaches and consultants that I'm networked with in the greater Philadelphia area where I live that, man, they really don't like sales. They don't like business development. Maybe I can do that and take a percentage of it. And so I thought Global Performance Institute sounds big, sounds like it'll be an institute of some sort, and maybe that could be my thing. And so initially when I made the move after my conversation with Svetlana, and I went full-time working for and on myself, I tried to market myself as a speaker, a coach, and a consultant. And it took about 10 days to realize that they were wildly different go-to-market strategies. And if I tried to do all three at once as a newly minted entrepreneur or wantrepreneur, as some people might call me at that stage, then I was going to be mediocre at all three. And I knew if I was going to succeed at something, I'd have to be excellent at it. I'd have to want to be excellent at it and want to put in the 15, 16, 18 hours a day it might take to get there. And so I thought, what's going to give me the most intrinsic satisfaction? Well, coaching, yeah. I love that aha moment that I get to see with people. I call them sparkles and smiles. I love the sparkle in somebody's eye when they realize something about themselves or they learn something new about the world. And I love the smiles that I get to put on people's faces when I'm up on stage entertaining them, playing the piano, or just doing something that makes people happy. So yeah, maybe coaching could do it. And consulting, God, even the minute I said the word, I was like, RFPs and corporate, nope. So I knew right away I was dropping the consulting part, at least for then. And then I thought, well, speaking. And I couldn't picture myself doing anything else. When I had decided that one of them had to be where I started my focus, I was like, speaking. I think being on stage, sharing a message that impacts people, there's the sparkles and smiles. I know I can do it because I've already got stage experience and stage presence from being an entertainer. Now I just have to figure out, how do you sell a keynote? What does the buying process and the marketing process look like? What are the expectations that a keynote speaker who's going to get X amount of dollars for, you know, their speech, what do they need to look like and sound like and appear like to a buyer? And I just tripled down on keynote speaking. And so the Global Performance Institute has been the business brand underneath all of that. But now that I've been doing it for 5 years, it's starting to become that sort of home for speakers who want to speak more, speak at higher fees, and eventually some consulting programs to help organizations determine whether or not they have Encore experiences in their workplace for their people. And through this Encore audit, how they can create better experiences for their internal audience, their employees.
It took a while. I love it that you share. It's not overnight. You know, you decide you want to do these things, but it takes time to find your niche. It takes time to develop it out and to be exceptional at what you do. So it's not an overnight decision.
Yeah. One of the first books I got recommended to me by someone was Lois Kramer's book, More Business. And there's a sentence in there that I reference all the time where Lois said, So many speakers are focused on being millionaires. They miss the opportunity to be 100,000-aires. And that line hit me because it was like, all right, if this becomes $1 million business, who cares? Could you imagine having this be a $100,000 business? Like that you did that on your own. You didn't need some company to give you that money. Like you did this. And so that laser-like focus of really for the first couple of months in the role, I came up with a number that was my keep the lights on number. And that was my focus. I wasn't worried about what my yearly run rate was going to be. I wasn't worried about how many speeches I was getting. I was like, I need, and I think at the time it was like $3,500 a month. Like I need $3,500. And if I sold a gig for $7,000, that was two more months of runway that I bought myself. And that's how I looked at the business, was to just keep it going, keep building momentum, just keep getting gigs and stage experience and opportunities. And just know that it will come if you're consistent with the activity and the approach and the focus on making the product better. And so that's really, and I still, to some degree, operate that way where I'm not like, oh, there's going to be X amount of dollars here. I'm like, what do I need for next month to be okay? And even though I've got gigs, even into 2026, I believe that thinking that way is essential to run a business like this, where it can be cyclical. And so consistency is key.
Love this. Okay, I want to ask you about culture. Culture is really a buzzword in business. And you have this very unique approach that's called the tip for culture concept.
Yeah, the tip jar culture. So think about a tip jar, right? So there's one right behind me. Okay, so take the letters out of it. It's a big fishbowl. And in the beginning of the evening at the piano bar, typically we do something called salting the tip jar. So what that means, we sprinkle a little money in there so that people know that's what's supposed to go in there is dollar bills, y'all, or really bigger dollar bills, y'all. We salt the tip jar, but then something magical happens. Kelly walks into my piano bar, fills out a slip. She says, Greg, I want you to play Only the Good Die Young. It's my favorite song. And then you slip a little $5 bill into the tip jar. Now other people see this and they come up and now I've got ones and fives and tens and twenties and maybe even a $100 bill from a high roller. The jar is filling up throughout the evening. Now what's fascinating, the jar is full of what?
Money.
All different denominations from all different people. So the quantity of money in that jar can be expressed as a number, right? It could be $100, $500, $1,000, it doesn't matter. But the constituent parts, what makes up that money, is a little bit of you, a little bit of them, a little bit of this person, a little bit of the other. It's a group effort to fill that jar. And that is very similar to culture in an organization. A CEO cannot just go, here's the new culture. Because culture is a little bit of Kelly, a little bit of Greg, a little bit of this person, a little bit of that person, and it all goes in a big jar that we call our organization. And the only way to change the composition of that culture is to change the people in the organization. And I don't mean this person leaves, this person arrives, although that's one way to do it. We are improving the caliber of the individual in the organization, because as they change, so does the composition of that metaphorical jar that we call organizational culture. So what I got curious about was, what are some elements that influence how we fill up that jar in the workplace? That's what the tip jar, I don't want to go on a big tirade about the content itself unless you want to go deeper, but that's at its core, that's what the tip jar culture is about, is creating the type of environment in your organization, in your company, in your association that allows people to bring their best self each day to elevate the experience of those, the performance of those around them.
Love that metaphor. I love what you put together. It makes total sense and brings it all together. One of the specialties you talk about is encore experiences. So mm-hmm. not just for customers, it's for employees. That ties into that?
So the encore experience is my newest keynote, and it came at the urging of many of my clients who were leadership groups, HR groups, CEO councils, things like that. They'd experience my keynote called the Tip Jar Culture, and they'd say, Greg, that was awesome. This is exactly the kind of thing we need. You have a keynote that's like appropriate for everybody, because we got lots of people in our organization who don't have direct reports. And I said, well, this, switch a couple words around and this can be appropriate. And they go, it really feels like it's for leaders. I wish if you had something different, man. So I, instead of trying to change the marketplace, let me just change the positioning a bit. And so the encore experience takes those ideas, and instead of applying them to the organization, applies them to the experience of an individual each day. It could be your colleague. It could be your coworker. It could be somebody in your community, a family member. And it says, what are the elements of an interaction with someone that make you want to have it again, that make you want an encore? And we also start from this premise that you're probably a top performer, whatever you do. My guess is you're giving 100% every day because you care, because this matters to you. So the most detrimental thing I can do to you is say, Kelly, I know you're giving 100%, but I need more. That's where burnout comes from. But more is what drives organizations. It's what drives the stock market. We need more. We need share price growth. We could talk about whether or not that's actually good for business. But the case is, this society right now runs on more. But the individual, I believe, runs more effectively on this idea of again. So more is good, but again is better. And so what do I mean by that? If you're at a restaurant and you have your dinner and you're finishing your entree and the server says, how is everything? And you go, I wish I had more on my plate. And not only is that not a good sign, but it probably means you're going to pay more. In that moment, you've already decided on the price of your entree. Now you got to shell out another couple bucks for another 4 ounces of steak or whatever it is that you're eating, right? Yeah. Versus the server comes to your table at the end of the entree and says, how was everything? And you go, God, I can't wait to come back again. This was phenomenal. Now, what happens is the restaurant winds up making more money because you come back again.
It's the again experience. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It's about getting people to want to come back in again and have the experience. That is cool.
Yeah.
When you walk into an organization and they're struggling with engagement, what's the first thing that you look for? What's the biggest red flag that a company's culture is failing? And then how do you respond to that?
That's a big question with a lot of aspects or avenues down which we could go. But I like to start with the employee experience. Not what is it like? Do you have kombucha on tap, or do you have a ping pong table or a rest and meditation room? What is it like to do the work here? Is it easy? Is it bureaucratic? Are there meetings after meetings? Are there side conversations that happen? What is it like to actually work here? Because I find that to be one of the drivers of disengagement, is when the process, the act of doing the job, is harder than it has to be, because that's not the way we've done it. A new change wants to be implemented, but that's not the way we've done it. We do it this way. Or there's so many fragile egos at play in an organization. I see this in, I don't want to lose work in a particular arena, but I see this in law firms and in medical centers and anywhere where there's lots of real type A personalities who have spent a lot of time building their reputation and their body of work. Oftentimes, the humility and the courage required by someone to say, I don't know, is absent in these organizations. And that makes the work harder for everyone else. I know this is shocking, right, Kelly?
It just really kills innovation if you have to deal with people at the top that are like, we've decided it's going to be this way, and this is what works, and we're going to keep doing this. Then there's no need for me. There's no need for your employees. They just go, okay, if you don't need a thinking person, you just need a provider of activities, then great for now, but I'll be looking somewhere else so that I can find better engagement and something more interesting that expands my talents, my interest, and my enthusiasm.
And that's a great lead-in or example of why the request slip is such a unique tool in our arsenal at the piano bar. Because technically, if you think about it, I'm the expert when it comes to music in the room. It's literally what I get paid to do. So why do I need Kelly's request of only the good die? You know, why do I don't need you? I want your money in the tip jar, but technically I am well-versed and smart enough. And I'm, for those of you who are just listening and not looking, like I'm being very sarcastic here, I am clearly well-versed and smart enough to put on the best performance anyone in the world has ever seen. So what I just really need from you is just clap, tell me how amazing I am, and keep ordering drinks. And in essence, there are some organizations where leaders behave that way. They don't realize that they are appointed to a leadership role to help remove obstacles. They feel like they've been anointed and finally recognized for the godlike creature that they are. And so they go around thinking, how could you possibly have an idea better than mine? You've not been a senior vice president. And what's so fascinating is that the piano bar, the whole evening's experience is built on the ideas of the audience, who very likely have no musical skill, maybe have never been paid to perform professionally. And yet when we use their requests to build the experience through the evening, the night is always more engaging. We fill up our tip jar 10 times over. And it's because there's that give and take. In my book, I mentioned the work of a woman named Mary Parker Follett. So Mary Parker Follett is often referred to as the mother of modern management. And so her body of work was really happening around the turn of the century, the 1800s into the 1900s. And what she would always say is that power with is more sustainable than power over. And coming out of the Industrial Revolution, where it was very much power over, that was the dynamic. Her contention was that we're going to get more engagement. Back then, they called it worker satisfaction. We're going to get greater worker satisfaction if we share power with, if we let their ideas be brought into the mix as well. And that's what we see at the piano bar. And that is what organizations can implement if they are not already doing this to increase employee satisfaction, talent retention, minimize burnout. This idea of sharing power with.
That's such a great concept. And and from the tip jar idea, as you were speaking, I was thinking, wouldn't it be interesting if companies didn't have, what do you call it? The complaint box, the even if it's anonymous, the complaint box, and instead they had the request box. They had the request jar where you could now put your ideas into it that sometimes aren't such obvious solutions from your workers that management doesn't see because they're not in the pit. They're not on the front line all the time. They're at the top of the stairs in the white room. They're not thinking about it. So what an interesting transition that would be in a company to say, listen, request jar, please put your name in and you get acknowledged better. Yeah. Than here, you can put in your complaints or your observations and they can be anonymous. That's not very healthy. That's ratting people out.
There's an important distinction that we need to make between this idea of a request and what at the piano bar we would call a suggestion. And the difference is money. If you bring a request slip up to me without something green and presidential, it is not a request. It is just a suggestion. So I need your money. And so how do we make that relevant for the average person? I'm not saying you should pay your boss to listen to your idea, but that money is a symbol of buy-in, of skin in the game. And I think too often what we see in anyone who's ever been on a committee or a PTA association or has ever worked on a school project in a group setting will know what I'm talking about. There are a lot of people who want to see things done, but want to have no role in actually doing them. Hey, this is a good idea, but you should do it, not me. And there is a need in the corporate sector, in the world, if you're going to put forth an idea, you've got to be willing to actually do something in service of that idea. And this is a tricky one for some organizations to implement, I've learned. Some do a really good job. Like in my book, I mention an organization called CSG Human Services. They're actually out in Western Pennsylvania. And they implemented a sort of Shark Tank approach to the request slip, if you will. So an employee submits an idea, an improvement, a change to an innovation council who's made up of different executives and senior leaders from across the company. And they all take a look at it, this innovation council, and make sure that it's not, you know, against their corporate values or just so far afield that it doesn't even bear consideration. But so long as it's not a wacky idea, they invite that employee in virtually or in person to pitch the idea like a Shark Tank. Now, they're not giving facts and figures and stats and stuff yet, but it's just tell us more about this idea. How do you see it working? How does this problem apply to you? Where else could this be impacting our business? And then if the Innovation Council sees merit in this, one or more will become the idea sponsor. Like a shark says, okay, I'll invest. And so now what's happening is the employee is getting mentorship, working side by side with this executive sponsor or sponsors. So they've got their skin in the game now because they're expected to do some of the heavy lifting. They're starting to build and network with other leaders in the organization. So now they're feeling like they matter, and they do. And sometimes these ideas move all the way through the process and become implemented company-wide. And so now they're seeing recognition, and they can literally go home to their colleagues, to whomever, and point at something and go, I did that. I helped make that happen. And that feeling is so fundamental to the human experience, Kelly. It's something that a psychologist named Carl Gruss discovered when he was doing his work as a psychologist. It was focused on how children develop social networks. And children develop it predominantly through play. So he would study children at play in different scenarios. And he discovered that by about 18 months of age, children have this awareness of their ability to create action, movement, change in the world. Carl called this the joy at being the cause. And so in my keynote, I share a story. I'll show you the brief version of it. We were playing with sidewalk chalk on our front porch. Me, my wife, my daughter, Frankie, who at the time was about 18 months old. She's got this piece of sidewalk chalk. She wants a different color. So she puts it on a table. And this table is very wobbly because it's from Home Goods. So this wobbly table from Home Goods, the chalk goes on it, but it wobbles and the chalk rolls off. So she goes to pick the other piece up, and I lean over faster, pick it up, hand it back to her. But she doesn't want this. She wants the other piece of chalk. So she puts the chalk back on the table. It rolls off again. Hand it back to her. She does it again, but this time she doesn't even look at the other chalk. She's now looking at me, because she's realized that if she puts the chalk on the table and it rolls off, Daddy's going to bend over to pick it up, and I can make Daddy bend over. Look at the sequence of events. And she starts to track that.
She is being trained, and I did it.
Right. And we don't lose the joy at being the cause when we get older. We may forget that it's there. We may bury it with RFPs and emails and procedures and time off and paychecks and 401ks and all these other things that we see externally as important or as defining our work. But the true intrinsic drive that we have as people, folks with a heartbeat and a brain, is to see that we did something today that made something different out there. It could be for our family, for our community. And in remembering that, in keeping that at our forefront of what we do, That creates an encore experience for us each day. That, I believe, is the most important thing we can find each day, is to experience the joy at being the cause.
Absolutely right. I love that perspective. And I would say that I think it is just such basic human nature that we want to be seen, whether that's in a business situation, whether that's with a company that you work for, or in the relationship that you're in with your spouse or your loved ones or with your kids. You want to be seen. You want to know that they see you.
Mm-hmm.
So being the cause is so critical. And sometimes just that someone sees who you are, what you do, has so much value that carries for so long. That's why employee recognition is so important in a company, that people get acknowledged for the contributions that they make. And when they go beyond the call of duty, so to speak, and I think it's really critical. So I love what you stand for, what your mission is. You decided to write a book about this. The book, I will say to everyone, is The Tip Jar Culture, How to Reengage and Reignite Your Workforce. What made you decide to do that at the time that you did? What was the impetus there?
Thank you for reminding me that I had the power to decide to do it, because in the moment, it felt like I was getting pushed by a lot of clients who, after the keynote, they would say, "Oh, this was great. We want the book. We want to give everybody the book." And I was like, "There is no book. Like, the world doesn't need a book from me. There's lots of books out there. Go read those." But people kept asking, and after conversations with my wife at one point, she's like, "Yeah, I think you got to write a book." And I was like, "Oh, I think I do have to write a book." And it was an illuminating process. It was, in some respects, way easier than I thought. I do like to write. I enjoy writing. I hate editing. That was much harder than I thought it was going to be, the process of editing and working with editors who are wonderful people. I'm just not good at editing. That was very challenging for me. And what was most illuminating about it, I think the best about it, was I started writing in 2022. And immediately when you write ideas down that you've been speaking from stage, you start to critically analyze it a little bit more and go, is that what I really want to say? Or is it something else that I think I'm saying? So I got so much clearer on what I was really saying in the process of writing the book. And I was fascinated. I did not expect that as an outcome, but the work that I do is head over tails better because of it.
The deeper dive creates more clarity and more depth to what you do when you have to put it on paper.
Yeah.
What's something unexpected that you learned about yourself in that process? What do you think when in writing that book? Yes, that it was a deeper experience, but did you find that it was something you would want to do again?
Yes, it's definitely, I liken it to the experience of getting married when Kim and I were planning the wedding and we're like, oh my God, the caterers and the flowers, like all the crap you've got to learn how to do and negotiate with and pricing. And then you get done the wedding and you're like, where do I use this skill that I've just acquired? Because now I'm all of a sudden really good at this. And I understand, pull this lever. This thing doesn't matter. This thing does. I think the process of writing a book is a lot like that, in that now, as I'm in the research phase for my second book, which, surprise, surprise, is going to be called The Encore, there's stuff that I'm doing now that I didn't do prior to my first book that would have made it easier, like setting up a lot of the interviews and everything way in advance of me even starting the outline of the book. And there's stuff that I'll do differently with respect to how I work with editors, what editors I work with, how much time I put into certain areas of the book that was a real time suck for me in the initial book that I think will yield a different outcome in this second book. And then lastly, I think for any author, you can write a book in 6 months. You can. What I found is that the breathing period between the first draft of a chapter and then going back for the first revision and then the second revision, the way that I did it the first time was with a program, sort of a coaching, here, we're going to get this book, you're going to do this book in 12 months from idea to execution. It was a lot of work. I'm not upset at the work. But what I am upset that I didn't do for myself was build in more time for breathing room to be able to go back to the chapter and say, actually, I want to reword this way. And there's one particular story, not to ruin the reading experience for everybody, because I'm proud of the work that I did. But as a incredibly self-critical human being, I look at this chapter and I go, oh, I wrote that story in the negative. And if I'd written it in the positive, it would have been this much more. And I realized that 6 months after it was published, and I'm reading it again, I'm going, oh man. So I think more breathing room for any author that's going to approach the book. Give yourself time to build in breathing room. That would be my advice for any author.
Brilliant suggestion. Absolutely brilliant recommendation. I think that's so powerful. I think we're all in such a rush to create all the time and to make all these things happen. And it gets lost in translation. It's so important to give yourself breathing room for anything. If I'm creating a new concept for something, I can whip it out. But the truth is, if I give a little space, if I walk around a little bit and give myself a little bit of time to come back to it and look at it from different eyes, I can remember my father always saying, rise above whatever it is that you're doing and look at it from different perspectives. And that's been such great advice, I think. Mm. So let me take you in where I just cannot wait to have this conversation, this part of the conversation with you. It's so important, is public speaking. This is obviously a place that you shine. You obviously are, and from everything about you, you're just a brilliant storyteller, which we already know that today, that you have no problem engaging an audience. And you've done something very interesting. You financially have done really well speaking. It seems that you did not start at the bottom of the bowl, obviously, starting from scratch. You already had stage presence. You already were comfortable on stage. This was easy for you. But to make like six figures in your first year, please tell the audience some secrets to that or some tips that you could give that can help them with the struggle of trying to figure out how to get paid and how to bump their price up. That's great. But how did you do this in 12 months? That's insane. Yeah. That's insane.
Thank you. The biggest misconception I think people have about this industry, especially those who decide they want to get into it initially, is that if you have a good idea and if you're good on stage, you can be a speaker. And I think that is the recipe for failure for a speaker. I think if you can communicate the power of your idea, and if you can identify the group of people who need to hear your idea and convince them to give you money to tell them your idea, you could be a really good keynote speaker. It's a bonus if you're already great on stage and are a great, eloquent speaker, a polished storyteller, whatever. But I started helping speakers build the business side of their business. And so many people say, gosh, I wish I hadn't spent $15,000 on this course where they help you write your perfect keynote. And I'm like, yeah, you've got a great keynote and no revenue stream. So what you really have is a hobby. And it's so unfortunate that people do that, because any other industry, very few industries would build the finished product and then try to go to market. Think about real estate. You're building a community of 40 homes. They don't build 40 homes. They build one. And they go, do you like it? Buy it. Buy it. Right? So what does that mean for a speaker? I would say, don't become obsessed with the speech itself. Become obsessed with the framework of the speech. Really, you don't need to sell a speech. You need to sell what that speech is going to feel like and what that speech is going to do for the audience. So what is it that you need to work on? Build a session description. That's the outline of a speech. That's all you really need to get started. And I think it's the statute of limitations or whatever is probably expired by now. I sold my first 7 keynotes at almost full fee, never having delivered a keynote before. I didn't even have the damn speech written. I just had an idea of what I wanted that experience to feel like and some of the main points I wanted to hit on. And so in the pre-call pre-contract calls, I just kept going back to that. It's going to be awesome. Here's the stuff I want to cover. But I understood at a very deep level the customer's problem. So it was never about, this is why my speech is so amazing and this is blah, blah, blah. It's your people are feeling burnt out by change, that it's change after change, and they're not sure how to navigate it. And we had to deal with that too as piano bar performers, constantly delivering a performance that was going to crush it every night. And I had no idea what the request slips were going to be. They're feeling the same way I did. And here's what I learned as a piano bar performer, is that there are ways you can roll with those changes and actually make them a valuable asset to the performance. And so when I deliver this keynote, yeah, it's going to have lots of music, but your people are going to get actionable strategies that they can take. And I've got the meeting planner going, yeah, yeah, that's what I want. Great. Send me the check. Thank you. Now I've got a couple of dollars in the bank. I have the psychological and the financial freedom to go, all right, I'm going to take one day out of my week, and instead of doing phone calls from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., I'm going to work on this speech and come up with a story or two. I still hadn't built the whole speech. Now, I will be completely honest. I probably would have crashed and burned if it weren't for COVID, because my sales ability far outpaced what my keynote was initially. So I had a coach who advised me that I should start selling myself at $10,000. And so that was my opening gambit. I went out at 10K. I was not, from a stage presence standpoint, yeah, everybody enjoyed the program. It was fine. But now looking back at the quality of the content and the cohesiveness of the points I was making, I was maybe a $3,500, $5,000 speaker. And I think had I done too many programs at 10K out in the real world, I only got to do two before COVID happened. So we've pivoted the others to be virtual. But had I done more, I think people would have started to be like, hey, this guy may not be worth 10 grand right now. Maybe pass on him. But I also continued to invest all that money back into marketing and growing my website and my photography and my videography. And I continue to relentlessly invest in the business. And so for somebody just starting out, I've gone off a bit afield of your question. For somebody just starting out, what I would say is don't spend your time and money worrying about the whole speech. Spend your time and money worrying about your client, whose need you can serve best. What is the problem your speech or your idea solves best for a business? Because that's where the money's at. They're going to pay to solve that problem. We pay more for painkillers than we do for vitamins because we really want to get rid of the pain. And we're not, it'd be nice to be healthier, but honestly, I'm not dead now. So like, I think I'll be okay. So I see a lot of speakers who are like, oh, I can make things better. And it's like, okay, that's a low fee dollar speech there. If you want a high fee dollar speech, you got to fix a problem. So focus less on the speech itself and focus more on the problem that you're going to solve, the outline or that idea that you can sell to a meeting planner, and then get relentlessly focused on identifying exactly who you can serve and when you can serve them. Because so many speakers just lob 500 emails out to meeting planners. And they go, hey, I'm a speaker and I speak on this topic and I'd love to speak for your event. Could we get on a call? Their event may be in 2 weeks. They don't care about other speakers right now. They care about their event. So knowing when to reach the right people with the right solution to their problem, that is the secret sauce for getting a speaking business going. And I think the blessing for me was coming from a sales background where I already got that. I understood that if you're going to really make a sale, it's about when, it's about who, it's about what. And then it was having that coach who could peel back the curtain for me of the speaking industry and say, here's what you need to say to sound a bit more polished. And here's what they're going to want to see to make it seem like you've been there before. But then COVID, at least here in Philadelphia, COVID became the great equalizer because I was a new speaker, but Mark Sharonbrock or who's somebody else I look up to, like Dan Thurman, Jason Hewlett, all these names, Victoria LaBalme, like they were all terrible at virtual too. It was new for all of us. So we were all equally okay on Zoom. And so this was my opportunity to go, okay, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to spend all my time. And so that really helped my speaking career because it leveled the playing field for a bit and allowed me to still make. So that again, probably like the second best worst thing to ever happen, at least for my business, was COVID and this sort of move to virtual.
Well, it's true. COVID really changed the game. And I always say, as tragic as it was on one level, It was a great opportunity for those who know how to pivot and look for what's new there, how they can, like you could just say right off the bat, Zoom, it's one of the greatest things that is global that has changed the game for everybody and certainly for the speaking world as well. And again, I love that you put the focus, there's some focus there on, you can know who your target audience is. This is very important. Who are you speaking to? What is it that you're looking for? What is it that you can provide? But in the end, the event planner is the one who hires you. This is a very important focus here, is what is, it's not about you. It's about the event planner, mm-hmm. right? And the event planner, what do they need? Because they don't care about your programs. They don't care about your path. They don't care about all that. They want to know, are you going to deliver for my event? Are you going to be, are you going to make me look good? Are you going to provide impact for my group that I'm representing? But in the end, that event planner has their own motivation, and you better be able to address that.
And I'd say even to, not to split hairs, but not even, are you going to make me look good? Are you going to make me look bad? That's a bit, some folks are like, I'm the greatest speaker. Like, great is a nice to have. What so many meeting planners need to solve for is good enough. Like, yes, they want a great speaker. I'm not trying denigrating or trying to say anything negative about meeting planners, but no one is going to buy you because you are the best. That's a nice to have. Meeting planners can get fired if they bring in somebody that absolutely bombs, that says something inappropriate. So like initially, their first sort of check the box moment is, does this person set off any red flags for me? Do they look like they'd make me look bad? And then once they have a pool of people that they feel are like safe enough, then they go, okay, out of this, who do I like the best? Who gets me the best? Because I'm going to spend several hours, maybe even a full day with this person. You're spot on. But I see so many speakers who are like, I'm the best. And like the best, nobody cares about the best.
Yeah, nobody
like, at this point.
Are you going to make me look bad if I put you on my stage?
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, so think of it that way. It's not about your great content, because honestly, that's not their focus. It's, are you going to make me look bad? And then I lose my gig. I lose my job.
Yeah. People don't come back. That's, you talk about encore experience again. Meeting planners are trying to solve for this. How do we create a conference experience that is not just, oh, I wish there were more bars at the reception, or I missed there, you know, I wish there were this. It's, I can't wait to come back again next year. Like, that's how they get more, is by designing an again quality experience or an encore experience. And so that's the same thing they're looking for. If you're a polarizing speaker, if you speak on a very controversial topic, like, whew, it's a tough road out there.
Risky, very risky. So, you know, you, again, are, the stage is home for you. That's part of who you are. Tell me, I'd love for you to share with the audience. There's a lot of professionals out there that are really good at what they do, but they resist public speaking, even when it could transform their business. What would you say to someone who is just simply afraid to put themselves out there? Is there anything, any tips that you could give that would put them at ease that this is doable and it will serve you? There's just a way to get out there if you're a little bit more on the nervous part, the resistant side. Do you have some advice for them?
I'm going to go deep and then I'll come back to earth. Or maybe I'll go like out into space and then I'll come back to earth. So I'm listening to a book.
Oh, well.
Listening to a book by Albert Brooks and Oprah Winfrey. I forget the title of it, but it's, I think it's like How to Design Your Best Life or something. It's interesting. But there's a part of it where Albert Brooks talks about this Buddhist question of what is the sound of one hand clapping? What is the sound of one hand clapping? The answer is it's an illusion. One hand can't make the sound of clapping. Our ear and our brain invents that sound, but really clapping is much different. And so it's a prompt for a Buddhist to stay in the moment and not have attachment, not be attached to an idea, not be attached to a... And what struck me is I realized I may not understand what he was writing about as deeply as I'm trying to now explain it to you, but here's the point. What struck me was that both on stage as a piano bar performer, as an entertainer, and as a keynote speaker, the moment I start to self-analyze or worry about my performance is the moment it falls off the rails. And as long as I'm keeping the audience and how I'm serving them at the forefront, the performance always finds a way to go well. And I saw the link between what I read and what I just said as to be This idea that we can do two things at once, we can self-analyze our performance and say something that's resonating with the audience, is an illusion. And I think stage fright, my belief is, anxiety, actual anxiety aside, it just like stage fright comes from a fear of how we're going to be perceived. And like we just said earlier, like, it's not about us.
Not about
you. It's about the meeting, the attendees, and the problem we're solving. And I think as long as someone who's got expertise in some domain that would help others and will help their business if they shared it more, they stop worrying about how they're going to look or how they might feel if they flub a word or forget something. And they just keep a relentless focus on what they can do for the other person through the value of their knowledge, that anxiety starts to diminish and we become more present in what we're doing. And then we do it better.
I just really appreciate your perspective. I think everybody wants to give a talk that will be unforgettable. And maybe that's the next round up, because first you want to survive the stage experience, make sure you haven't embarrassed yourself. And then you want to say something meaningful, number two, second stage. And the third is, I'd like to be unforgettable. I'd like to say something. I'd like to get up there and speak on something that really makes a contribution, that's meaningful. It's kind of a three-step process, I think.
My friend and mentor, Clint Pulver, said, I think he was speaking directly to me, but he was kind enough to speak in generalities. He said, people spend so much time trying to be profound, they should just be helpful and watch where that takes them. And I think that I will just say honestly and very open and vulnerably, I wanted to write that big, bold, memorable, oh my God, you gotta see it type of speech. And it was like trying too hard. And so folks who want to give that speech and they want it to be memorable and they want just share what you know. Like what is everyday and mundane to us is absolutely fascinating. And in fact, that was a gift Clint gave me in one of our first conversations. He said, I like your speech, but I think you need to take people into the piano bar even deeper, what it's like to be behind the bench, because that's something they don't know. They know what it's like to have a job because they've got a job. So don't talk about you having a job and what you did at your old job, because they got jobs too. It's a job. But they've never worked at a piano bar. And the more you can keep them in the world of the piano bar, the more fascinating that will be. And so for anyone looking to give a speech, if you're a financial planner, your clients are probably not. So they're interested in what you do. Even though it seems mundane to you, it actually is fascinating to that other person who you're trying to help. So just be helpful and you'll stumble upon the profound.
Work on telling the story well. And maybe that's where some of the skill set comes. But start with being authentic, because I think people relate to that. I think you really connect on that. So I guess I always like to finish my conversations with someone, ask them something that they may not be expecting. I'd love to ask what the legacy is that you want to leave. But really what I want to ask you is, what's something that you haven't done yet in your career, but you absolutely want to?
Oh, I want to do an arena. I want to do a 10,000 person or more. Like, I want one of those big arena shows. I just think it would be fun as heck to get on stage with that many people. I got to do a program a couple weeks ago in Chicago for just over 2,000 people. And it was one of those moments where I was off to the side before they're introducing me. They had like a couple points of business that they're doing. And I'm just looking at this crowd. It's one of the larger crowds I've spoken to date. And I'm looking at this crowd and I just said, you got to remember this, enjoy this, because get a little emotional. 5 years ago, you never would have thought this was possible. Like, you never would have believed you'd be giving a speech in front of 2,000 people in this big ballroom. And so there I am, and I go on and I have a bunch of different musical numbers in the program. And one of them is really high energy, highly engaging with the audience. And I get them to be probably as loud as they are at any point in the keynote in that moment. And so I'm up there playing the piano and I'm looking, and I realized that I had stopped playing the piano and was just listening to them sing. And I had this moment where I was like, you got to play the piano. Like, you are the music for this. You keep it going. So, it felt like an eternity to me. It was probably a split second and nobody noticed. But my point is, that is so amazing, that feeling of having 2,000 people singing with you, at you, definitely, And I would love to experience what it's like to be able to serve an audience of 10,000 or more, but also get to experience them singing. It's actually, this is a tangent, but I'll bring it back. It's actually one of my favorite things to do at concerts, especially like festivals, which I don't really get to go to anymore now that I have two young kids and I'm in my 40s, but I try to get as close to the stage as I can. And then I turn around and I look at the audience as if I were the performer. Now I'm not up on the stage and some, but I just, and I, every time I smile, cause it's just, God, this is so cool. Cause you see all those sparkles and smiles, all these people who are having this type of experience that it's the encore experience. It's, you look in their faces and you go, they're being energized by this. They're being fulfilled in some way. Yeah.
Notice they're coming together for something. I've seen Michael Jackson before. I'd had a chance to see him a couple of times, and he would come out and hold that audience. One thing he did so was hold the silence. He was very comfortable in holding the silence, minute and a half sometimes. He did that at the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
But then he would get to singing and then he'd stop and the whole crowd would be singing. He's one that I really noticed that experience with. There's something so magical about it. I just watched that documentary, We Are the World, when they all came and they were singing together and it just connected you. It's the connective tissue, and the fact that you come from a place of music makes this so unique. Greg, I just loved this conversation. And I gotta say, one of my favorite things about it is how much music has played a role in everything that you do. That's very unique, you know, dueling piano bars. And then keynotes. You've really blended it all together in such a unique way, which makes for a really interesting conversation, is what we're all about here. So I gotta tell you, I hope this won't be the last time we have you on the show, but I absolutely loved having you today. Thank you so much for your time and your energy and your impact here. I know people are going to be reaching out to you.
It's a pleasure. I'm so grateful you had me on.
It's so much fun. And the way you've tied this into business, I think people are going to walk away and think about how engagement really plays out and how they can do something different. They can do something innovative. So it's just beautiful. I'm very excited. And I love the encore concept that you've come up with. It's a different way to look at it. You've really tied it together. So if any of you out there, you want to connect with Greg, he made it really simple. GregoryOffner.com. If you're looking for him for speaking engagements or training and all the ways that he is helping companies transform the way they work, I definitely think you're going to want to reach out to him. And don't forget to grab his book, The Tip Jar Culture, How to Reengage and Reignite Your Workforce. You can get this on Amazon. Trust me, if you care about creating a workplace that people don't dread showing up to, you really need this book. It's very important. And public speaking. This is exactly the kind of guests that we look for to share their expertise and their unique point of view. And public speaking has clearly been a catalyst for Greg, not just for his business, but for his ability to shift mindsets and really inspire change. I think he's powerful in what he's done. I love your story about where it came from, how you got to where you are today. That, to me, that story will stick. And I think that's the magic of great storytelling and great speaking, and you encapsulate that. It really shows you how powerful your voice can be when you use it to elevate your message or your business. You can count on it being successful. So before we wrap up, I want to say thank you to all the listeners. Thank you. Believe me, your likes, your shares, your subscriptions really help us bring more incredible guests and conversations like Greg's. And we love hearing from you. So drop a comment, send us a message, let us know what resonated with you about this episode. All the details will be in the show notes, because at the end of the day, your voice, it's your greatest asset. Use it, own it, and watch what happens next. What's happened with Greg, really quite fascinating. And as always, I look forward to our next conversation. Stay tuned. See you next time. Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive once again into the remarkable stories and insights of our incredible guests.
Their experiences and hard-earned, time-tested wisdom are not just meant to inspire you, but to provide you with actionable steps to take on your own path to success. Remember, you have a story to tell, and your voice has the power to transform your business and make lasting impact. And that's what it's all about. If you found value in today's episode, let us know. And I hope you'll take a moment and subscribe to The Spotlight wherever you listen to your podcasts so you never miss a thought-provoking or idea-producing conversation. I'm Kelly O'Hara, and I can't wait to see you back here for the next episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight.